You are listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. In November of 2022, the Oregon Historical Society sponsored a symposium that centered Indigenous knowledge on the human experience in the Oregon Great Basin. Today, I'm joined by archaeologist Richie Rosenkrantz and retired Klamath Tribal Cultural and Heritage Director Perry Choctu to discuss their chapter in the recent thematic volume that came out of this session entitled Collaborative Understanding, Using Archaeology, History, and Indigenous Knowledge to Support Elk Conservation in Oregon's Great Basin. Perry and Richie, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here. So before we get into the project itself, I just wanted to talk briefly about the importance of publishing this work and that of your colleagues in a history journal. Not only does this put this project on the radar of folks who might not otherwise hear about it, but it's an important effort to make sure that Indigenous knowledge is represented as part of Oregon history. Perry, can you speak a little bit about this? Is this something that you have had experience with in the past, or was this kind of a new venue for you to talk about your projects?
Well, I've been talking about my projects for a long time, but elk's really close to home because that's something that we eat, you know, and your diet is really close to you. It's personal. And so I tried to teach my children just as how I have taught, to harvest animals, but do not over-harvest them, and to use a combination of botanicals and big game animals for your diet. I got to admit, I also like a beefsteak every now and then.
And do you think that this knowledge, you know, it's so important, you've got such great experience and expertise, but do you think most people historically have thought about that as history? I mean, I think all of us here recognize that, but this is a new way to think about like an animal as a conduit for telling a historical narrative.
Well, for us, we're very unique in that we have a hunting and fishing right that's still legit. To this day, we can go out and hunt and fish year round. And so with me doing that, my parents doing that, my grandparents doing that, I have to teach my children. Mm-hmm. And so both of my boys and my girl can hunt and fish.
I think about elk as something, and probably a lot of other Oregonians, as like we associate it with the coast. And this summer at our field school at Fort Stevens, we were camping literally inside a big herd. And I just found out recently that my property in southwestern Oregon was listed as an elk corridor, even though I've never seen one there in the whole time I've lived there. But can you, either one of you or both of you, tell us a little bit about what you're finding about the role of elk in the Northern Great Basin, which is drier and maybe less of a landscape that people think about this big game in?
Real quickly, Richie, I'll touch on that. If you look in the past, we had an elk right here that spanned decades before the time of the European, and it was a tule elk. And the tule elk were known for having a large set of horns on them. Well, what that does is it tells anybody that's hunting them, there they are. So it was pretty easy for them to shoot and hunt these animals to extinction. But before that, we hunted them as we needed them, and this is where they were at, right here at the border of California and Oregon. And so it was unique having a chance for our people to hunt them, but they are extinct now, but they didn't always be.
Can I chime in about that?
Yes,
I'll
please.
I'll just say that, you know, we think of elk as being kind of restricted nowadays because they kind of are. But as we talk about in the paper, elk prior to Euro-American incursion were one of the most widespread herbivores in North America, everywhere from northern Mexico up to the Yukon and across all environments of North America. So they're actually really adaptable creatures and pretty resilient.
Wow, I had no idea. And you write in your article that, you know, you highlight three important topics that are overlooked in traditional wildlife conservation. So in considering why all these animals are extinct and how to support new populations. But the three are an understanding of the deep history of elk in the region, how Indigenous people interacted with them, and how these interactions changed over time and through settler colonialism. So I know this is a humongous topic and it took your entire article to really cover, but can you just hit some of the highlights that really really show how incorporating these data points into conservation promotes success and has potential in thinking about it in the future?
So first, I think one of the key things that we document, and this is no surprise to Perry and other indigenous communities, is people in North America always coexisted with elk and other herbivores in responsible ways. We have consistent evidence in the archaeological record from modern times back to at least 13,000 years ago, where people hunted elk, used elk, and lived alongside them. And that dramatically changed when Euro-Americans arrived. And this was a big part for me in researching for this paper, is learning about in this historical interaction with Euro-Americans. So think of this is one of our key findings that we point out, is indigenous people lived alongside and hunted elk for 13,000 plus years, and it took Euro-Americans about 40 years to hunt them to near extinction in the area.
Yeah, that's quite a contrast.
Yeah.
You are listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we are talking about an interdisciplinary collaboration that focuses on elk conservation. So tell us a little bit about how you are seeing the elk-human interactions in the archaeological record. Like, what kind of artifacts are you finding? What kind of clues are you using to really document and trace this centuries-long, interaction?
Well, the primary thing is just the bones of elk in archaeological sites. And, most of those are the results, at least interpreted through archaeologists, as being food residues. Other ways are probably things more familiar to people, like tools, for example. So things for flint knapping, digging sticks, strips of hide that were part of clothing, or maybe like string of some sort. So a whole range of things. So anything that we could find in the archaeological record, I kind of compiled and put into this.
And one of the benefits, I guess, of working in the Great Basin is you do have preservation of like strips of hide. That's something in other parts of the state that would be unheard of to have preserved for that many centuries.
Yeah, the dry rock shelters are pretty special in the Great Basin, and they kind of provide these insights into the past that are often unseeable.
And Perry, you mentioned that you are an elk hunter and you've trained your kids to do this. And I know that you use the meat and the hide and the bones. And do you worry that these traditions will be lost if there's the elk aren't going to be able to continue to live in these areas? Like, what brings you to do, motivates you, I guess, to do this work to try to preserve these animals?
Well, the numbers really aren't going down. They're going up. And what it is when the populations explode upon the Cascade Range, they push each other out. And when they push each other out, well, I'll give you an example. In the last 20 years, we see elk now where we never used to see them. Uh-huh. I have a friend that has a picture of 2 6-point bulls drinking out of Lost River. That's kind of unheard of. That's pretty far east to get them. But they're pretty much on every vaulted and lofted area now. And so we're really happy with that. They're twice the size of a deer. So mm-hmm. It's like killing two deer if you shoot one single elk. Our infatuation with elk has gone on for a long, long period of time. Here is a letter from A.B. Meacham to Washington, D.C., dated 1870. And in it, it is saying that they do not have to fulfill their obligation of pounds per beef for tribal member for the Choctaw Band of Summer Lake. And it's because it's filled with a lot of good hunters. And so I come from a lot of really good hunters. And I tried to pass that on to my children. And my children have become good hunters too. But are you good at sharing? That's the point. I make sure that we share with our neighbors. We share with Richie. We share with everybody we come across.
Can I get in line?
That's because you can get in line. I do smoked fish, canned fish, dry deer meat, by the bags full.
I love
and
it.
Dry elk meat. And the reason why is because we're not in this world by ourselves. We're in it with you. And so my father used to make a point to give away a little bit of everything he makes. And that makes meat too. He makes meat too. And so I made sure to be a little bit like him. And one out of every 10 things I make, I give away. And I share our bounty because we're all in the same boat. But for the elk hide, living and making us live, they come in all shapes of form. This is a little knife with a brow tine off elk. This is for a friend of mine for Christmas. This is an elk brow tine put on the end of a digging stick to make a T-handle. In the old days, this is what we used before metal. So elk is so intricate in our lives.
And because the animals are so big, did that mean you had bigger bones to work with than like a deer, which is smaller? And I guess these giant horns you're talking about from the tule elk.
Yeah. Well, how I teach the kids when I used to do culture camp all the time is put it in the ground, wiggle, 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 and bend back. And the root comes up to the surface of the ground. So it was a little bit of elk that helped them dig that root up, mm-hmm. help them with their botanicals. And so we always tell them to revere life and revere death too, because it's a part of our life. And so it's a tough one, but we still do it. We still teach them because we think they deserve to know it.
Well, it's amazing to know that the elk are on a comeback and that they're doing great. And I think a lot of that is probably from this collaborative framework you're doing. So do you think that this could apply to other species? I know that similar efforts have been focused on sea otters on the coast, and they actually, the fall of 2023, Oregon Historical Quarterly talks about that. But are there other opportunities, do you think, where culture and history could really inform contemporary wildlife management?
I personally do, because I used to sit down in meetings once a month with like organizations like ODOT. I got ODOT to understand the importance of these animals, and they put in wildlife habitat corridors along Highway 97. And I'd like to think that was a result of our positive interaction.
Yeah, I know they're trying to put a corridor in I-5 just south of Ashland. I don't know how many elk walk through there, but maybe they will if they have a safe passage.
I sure hope so.
So, Richie, do you know of other archaeological colleagues that are teaming up on these kind of collaborative efforts focused on other species or other parts of the state?
Well, there's definitely a lot of work in Northern California and a little bit in Western Oregon, especially with things like fish and just habitat in general, especially and elk, too. In particular in Northern California. But there's, to answer your question, there's tons of opportunities. We really just focused on one species because, well, there's so much to say, right? And mm-hmm. I hope to, in the future, work with Perry and other folks to kind of expand this and look at mountain sheep and deer and pronghorn, because these things are all interconnected and interrelated beyond themselves. And another interesting thing that I'm hopeful to do is also dealing with bison, and especially tribes in the plateau are really interested in bison restoration and reintroduction of bison to tribal lands and to public lands. And there's a lot to be said about that. But when you look at bison in the archaeological record, you see a very similar pattern to what we talk about in this paper with elk. And so I think the opportunities are endless.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much to both of you for coming on and telling us a little bit about this project. You can read about the collaboration on elk habitat in the Oregon Historical Quarterly, the fall 2025 issues, and a lot of other great projects that come out of the same area, the symposium. And thank you both for joining me here on the show. Look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, this wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Show producer is Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.